now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this panel of oral arguments, March 12, 2019. We have four cases slated for oral argument today, one of those by ITV, and two non-oral cases on today's calendar. First matter on for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Wade. I'll just remind counsel, although you're experienced, that each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with 5 additional minutes for the appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we do keep track of the proceedings by audio recording. Button you're probably familiar with. If you're not, right in front of the podium, and you can lift the face of the lectern to your height. And with that, appellant's counsel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
I was actually not aware where there was a button.
There's
That's
a button.
New information for me.
Right in the front there.
Okay.
But your height seems to be perfectly matched. It's tailored to your argument.
Tailored to me. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Roy Spurbeck. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant Lamar Wade. Mr. Wade was convicted of a third-degree violation of the controlled substance statute in Blue Earth County District Court after a court trial and sentenced to 51 months in prison. This appeal raises one issue, whether Mr. Wade was denied his right to a speedy trial and whether the remedy for this constitutional violation is dismissal charges. When evaluating a defendant's speedy trial right, whether a defendant's speedy trial rights have been denied, I know this court is familiar with the test. It's the four-part test from Barker versus Wingo. The court's going to consider the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, whether the defendant asserted his or her right to the speedy trial, and prejudice. The length of the delay is the triggering mechanism which determines if whether further review is necessary.
In addition to being triggering, however, I gather that it's also a factor in how much delay there was.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of an interesting thing when you look at the cases is Rule 11 provides a rule-based mechanism for moving the trial along, Rule 1109. And we have a 60-day and 120-day benchmark within there. The case law also very clearly recognizes a triggering date, which is simply arrest and charging for the constitutional part of this. So when we're considering what is the delay in bringing the defendant to trial, is one of the things we're going to look at is total delay, and then the second part of it is, well, what's the reason for the delay? So we have a triggering mechanism which moves us to the rest of the test, and I think that's a very long answer to Judge Klopaki's question of you're going to look at one and two together.
What's the interplay between, it seems lost in the cases to me, and maybe you can shed some brilliance on the subject for me, but the interplay between the rule allowing for or mandating release and the determination of a violation that requires dismissal.
Well,
how clear
I think,
is that in the law?
Sure. You could have a, again, this goes back to the rule-based remedy without exigent circumstances after 120 days. We're going to go back to the bail rule and you're going to be released. That is, you could have a very, very short time period from charging to that 120-day violation, which may not trigger a constitutional issue, but under the rules, it's going to be a remedy of release.
But it's the same factors, it seems, the courts have applied in applying the rule and determining a constitutional violation.
I agree, and I had this discussion with a colleague yesterday of what is the interplay between these rules and the constitutional part. I can't shed any brilliance on it other than I agree with you. That within the case law, we seem to look at Barker to determine both. Now, on appeal, my argument is almost universally going to be there's a constitutional violation because I'm looking for dismissal of the charge.
Now, the district court in this case analyzed it and reached a conclusion that the rule was met and release was mandatory,
mm-hmm.
and it found factors that would seem to corroborate your argument, but it did not dismiss. Am I correct that at that time, even though it seems like there was a request for a speedy trial and then some notion that there was a withdrawal of the request for a speedy trial or dismissal, what at that moment, what was pending before the court? Was there a request for dismissal at that time, and the court chose
on the December, I believe it's a December 1st order, which is in my addendum. That ruling is for release. Later in December, when they come back to court, I believe it's a December 21st motion and hearing, the defense attorney says, you know you released him, but I think the proper remedy here is dismissal. Judge says no. They come back in January, early January, from where the court trial is set, and the defense attorney once again says, I really think dismissal is proper. He did not ask for dismissal in the late November hearing because I really think that I feel for this defense attorney because he is simultaneously trying to litigate to the best he can some of these, what I would call Rasmussen issues and some discovery issues in this case. At the same time, he has a client whose really number one priority is to get out of jail in Mankato and get into federal custody to resolve a federal issue. So he is continuously sort of balancing, asking for, please release my client. He'll come back, he'll waive speedy trial, he'll sign the extradition order, and kind of running into roadblocks, but he's asking. Now, at the same time, he's got to be prepared to move the case along in that time period. And really, this case to me is about, if you're going to defend it in the trial court, it's really about that search warrant and the Franks hearing. So he's got to do those things while he's simultaneously balancing the defendant wanting to, he's not going to get out of custody. He's going to go to that federal hold. But that's the defendant's real priority. Now, I'm sure the defendant would love to have the state case dismissed also, but that seems to be his priority. So when the trial judge, Judge Anderson, does.
So what do we do with the time after the trial court allows him to be released to federal custody, so yep. He doesn't really get out of being in custody?
But it is what he wants.
Is there any prejudice that's attached to that time period?
That time period, I think, goes to the global, under State versus Jones, the test of when were you charged, and you know, when were you charged, were you in custody at the time, under State versus Jones, all the way up to when did we have your trial? And in this case, that is about 11 and a half months. So the December 1st release to federal custody, 5 weeks later we have the trial, that is still part of the constitutional calculus.
So what?
There's no rule issue there under Rule 11, but it's all part of a long time period.
But that long time period, I'm trying to get, going back to Judge Klopaki's question, in the sense, one of the elements, you know, his argument as to whether or not, you know, to what extent it matters, but the prejudice element.
Mm-hmm.
So I gather, as best I can discern, although it wasn't specified in the district court, that release from state custody would have resulted in federal custody. It's not as if he goes home. What is the extent of the overlap, and how, if at all, does it matter?
I don't think it matters, and I wish I do not have the case on the tip of my brain, but the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, has opinions where they basically say, we care about the speedy trial even if you're serving another prison sentence. You know, we're not going to, that's not good enough to make it go away. So,
but it matters, doesn't it, in the analysis?
Well, I think it matters in some calculus in prong four of the Barker test. So, you know, we've got these three things we're going to look at. Let me flip and make sure I have them right. Oppressive pretrial incarceration, anxiety, concern of the accused, possibility the defense will be impaired. I have no specific point where I can say there's defense impairment. If I had something, I would tell you, and it would carry great weight in the case. I don't have that. It is not necessary to find a violation. It's a fact. But when you look at anxiety and concern of the accused, Mr. Wade, I think at the December 21st hearing, and then I think possibly in the first, before the court trial starts, he makes some effort to explain to the judge that he's lost his business, he's been deprived family, he can't support the family. I believe his wife was shot while he was in jail in Mankato.
Wouldn't all of this have been true, though, if he'd been released earlier? Because he'd be in federal custody.
Well, I think what Mr. Wade's, I think one of the things what Mr. Wade was trying to get across is if he can dispose, and I think that's why that was his priority, was disposing of that federal case and then seeing what happened. So, yes, he does move into federal custody in December and then come back for his trial, but I think the point he was trying to make and what the attorney was trying to advocate for him was, get him into federal custody and let's see what happens. So I agree, for this 5-week period, he's in federal custody. If he had been released back in the spring, I don't know that he would have been in federal custody that whole time. Now, you know, Blue Earth County's going to have a hold on him. He's going to come back to Blue Earth, but at that point, maybe he makes the bail, maybe that kind of thing happens. But there's no point in him making the bail on the state case while the federal hold exists. And I do think what is driving, from what I know, I think part of what's driving these requests to get to federal court is if he gets into federal court and can resolve that in some way, what is essentially a federal supervised release violation, it's not a probation violation, there are real tangible custody credit issues and how the Federal Bureau of Prisons awards custody credit. And there are doctrines of primary and secondary jurisdiction and which court are you the primary in. But the Federal Bureau of Prisons will often not award custody credit for a defendant's state court time, even though they are basically sitting on both.
And
I think at the end of the day, that's maybe what's driving.
This case seems like it has some of the clunkiness in the procedure as Windish. Do you agree with that or not so?
I do, but not as bad. I think that when
not
I...
Not as bad as Windish?
I don't think so. To be honest, I don't think it is.
Well, the difficulty there is Windish, I mean, the Windish court does say that it's going to dismiss the charges, but it doesn't do so on constitutional grounds. In fact, it says that there's not a speedy trial violation, but in the Supreme Court supervisory role.
I think to great frustration of many practitioners.
Right, and yeah. Windish seems to set a floor. And I don't know that your client reaches it, given what I suppose practitioners in your shoes would read Windish and think, well, this is a clear speedy trial violation. Surely the court, till you get to the punchline, surely the court's going to dismiss the charges. But it doesn't.
No. Well, in this court, of course, doesn't have a supervisory powers.
Right. Right, and so we're stuck with only the Constitution, and if Windish... Yeah. was not a constitutional violation. How do you distinguish this case? How do you make this case worse than Windish for
Well, I don't think you have to be as bad as Windish. And I think in
Why not?
Because this court has speedy trial violation dismissals cases that I would say are not as bad as Windish. Griffin, I don't think is as bad as Windish. That is a case where this court on appeal went through the factors and said constitutional violation, dismissed. So, I don't think you have to be as bad as Windish. All of these cases really, and I know this is true, and a lot of the cases we do, really are driven by what is actually happening fact-wise. Part of this clunkiness, if you want to call it, is defendants obviously, most of them, I shouldn't say obviously, but most of them are going to be litigating some pretrial issues while their case is pending in the trial court. There has to be some balancing of, you have a right to litigate your Fourth Amendment issue, you're going to do it. Well, at the same time, you can't ignore the Sixth Amendment part of this, which is the thing has to be moving.
In other words, the defendant's right to a speedy trial isn't eroded by the exercise of his right to challenge evidence on Fourth Amendment grounds.
Fourth, Fifth Amendment, yeah. And that can't be it. And I think when I have read this record, it was probably back in September, I read it several times to try to figure out what was happening over the course of the summer in this case with the motions and the hearings, and I had trouble figuring it out then. And then I reread it in anticipation of the argument, and I was reminded how it's hard to figure out.
I had a hard time figuring out the timing of the speedy trial demand and then the withdrawal of the speedy trial demand and what effect that has on our
The defense attorney is constantly advocating for the speedy trial and the dismissal, but of course he has to hedge it at times to say, the one specific one I remember is he has to hedge it when the judge says, well, you know, I need some time to make the Franks ruling. And the defense attorney's like, well, of course. Well, that to me has some delay attributable to the defendant because he needs the ruling. Because if the judge rules in his favor, Franks, and dismisses, well, that's good for the defendant. So there are times like that where I feel like he's hedges. I also think there's times where the defense attorney is really trying to be very reasonable, where he's just trying to say, if we can just get him into federal custody, we'll waive speedy. There's several points like that, but of course that doesn't happen until we have Judge Anderson's order on the rule-based speedy trial violation. I see my time is expiring. Thank you. We'd just ask this court to review the speedy trial claim and dismiss the charges on the constitutional violation. Thank you.
Thank you. Respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Hersey. I'm a special assistant Blue Earth County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this action. In response to some of the questions by the court, I would say that the rule provisions dealing with speedy trial and the constitutional provisions and issues are interrelated, but they're distinct. And I think in this case, we're focusing on the four Barker factors. And I believe Judge Klopp-Hockey is correct that while the time is a triggering element under the rule, we still look at the delay as a factor in the Barker analysis.
About the fact the trial court made a finding, as I recall, I'm looking for it now, I can't find it, but I thought the trial court made a finding that the state's response to the argument about the confidential informant ought to, even though there is delay and a request for a hearing, that ought to be on the side of the run against the state because you didn't respond appropriately. That's not the language of the trial court, but to that effect.
That's correct, Judge. I believe it was the second judge in the release order that indicated the state was not as timely as it should have been with some of the disclosures.
District Court attributed the delay substantially to the state.
The court used language to that effect, correct.
I was concerned about your, maybe you can help me out. Your brief makes a statement that the state complied with the district court's discovery orders. That seemed inconsistent with what the district court said about the state's responses.
Well, I would suggest, Judge, that first of all, none of the transcripts were available to the second judge. We had two judges here. One judge retired, and Judge Anderson picked up later on. And Judge Anderson was the judge who issued the release order. But it was Judge Walker who handled most of the discovery provisions. And I believe it was in Judge Walker's August 11th order where he said, except for the probation records, which could only be disclosed by court order, it appeared that the state had complied. And I don't see any reference to that in Judge Anderson's December 1st order, finding that he did have to release the appellant at that point.
But the state, I gather, is not challenging the findings. And we have to rely upon the findings of the district court in some regard here. Is that a finding where the district court concludes that the state is responsible in large part for the delay?
I would submit that that's actually a legal conclusion, and ultimately I agree with counsel here that the court's review in this case, the standard of review, is de novo. And one thing that Judge Anderson...
The point is, if the trial court made a finding, we need to consider that finding.
You need to consider a finding of fact as long as it's not clearly erroneous. I would point out that Judge Anderson's findings, because he did not have transcripts of the proceedings and the arguments before Judge Walker, he did make a clearly erroneous finding. And that one was the fact that there had been no finding by Judge Walker of good cause to go past the 60-day time frame. The prosecutor argued to Judge Anderson, well, the judge did that orally. And in fact, going back to the transcripts, we see that now, and I've cited that in my brief. Judge Walker did, in fact, find good cause. So when Judge Anderson made the determination that there had never been a finding of good cause to go beyond the 60-day, that was a clearly erroneous finding. And I would submit that in light of the fact that Judge Anderson was ruling with limited information, did not have the transcripts of the arguments, did not have the transcripts of the oral statements of Judge Walker in the many hearings, that this court has the right to look at the transcripts and determine if perhaps some of the weight given to the judge's finding is appropriate, because the judge made one clearly erroneous finding. The others are basically based on what limited record the judge had.
And specifically, you're saying Judge Anderson's clearly erroneous finding is what? Which finding?
He said that there was never a finding by Judge Walker that there was good cause to go beyond the 60-day. And I've cited twice in my brief.
Well, he says that, but then he follows up in reference to his own judgment, it seems. The next sentence says, this court finds no such exigent circumstances existed, and the defendant's right to a speedy trial was not upheld.
It
seems independent of the previous determination.
He did say that, Judge, but I would suggest that there, when he's saying that, he's referring to the 120-day rule, because that's the standard for the 120-day rule, not good cause for going beyond the 60 days. And so that's why I refer to that finding as a clearly erroneous finding. I would submit that while the total time is to be considered from the time of charging on a constitutional analysis, that some of the motions were repetitive motions that the court had to rule on. I believe that there were 8 motions at various times to have the appellant released to the federal hold, and they kept getting denied. He'd make them again, denied again. And then there was the Franks motion. He made that Franks motion on June 6th, again on June 12th. That had to be heard by the court before they could get to the trial date. And in fact, the Mensis records show that in early September, I think it was September 3rd, the trial scheduled for September 12th was stricken and the Franks hearing was scheduled. So,
but didn't the trial court also find that the state did not disclose all of the requested information, forcing the defense to bring multiple motions?
That is true.
That's going to add to the delay then.
That is true. But if you go to the transcript, at the very beginning of the court trial, that same judge, Judge Anderson, also orally said on the record that much of the delay here was due to court congestion, court calendaring, and that has to fall on the court. I can't say that the state is to blame or words to that effect. So he did put that on the record, which tempers somewhat the language that he had in that order. And he put much of the responsibility for the delay on the court.
Regardless of what the judge said, where the responsibility for the delay lied, what does the case law say? If the court doesn't calendar, if the court is non-responsive to moving a case along, that's just neutral?
Can we
just wipe that out?
No. Let me put it this way. One of the cases where it was exclusively calendar congestion. And that was in Hennepin County, where they had a new system to try and clear up a backlog, where it was just court congestion. That fell against the state. It was not the defendant's problem. But in other cases, the court has indicated that is not held strongly against the state because the state has very little, if any, control over the court calendar. And so I would submit that in this particular case, this should not be held strongly against the state.
What can you say about the third factor as it relates to the statements made in this case about the request for a speedy trial? As I understand it, there was an immediate request for a speedy trial made back in January of 2017, and there were other requests made along the way, and then apparently withdrawal of the request. Can you what's the state's position on that factor in, under these circumstances?
And I apologize.
Try to lay out those circumstances because the record was a bit sketchy as to when those requests were made.
Correct. My recollection, and I apologize if I misstated, but my recollection currently is that there was a speedy trial made. It was dated June 17th. It was actually filed on June 26th, my recollection of 2017. And my recollection is that was the earliest speedy trial demand.
That's the written demand. Was there any oral demand?
I do not recall, but I can't say there wasn't, but I don't recall an oral demand. I do know that at the Rule 8 hearing, defense counsel waived the 28-day requirement for the omnibus hearing, even though he was warned by the court that if they waived that time, he had a right to trial in 60 days, and they couldn't guarantee if they could get it. And they were fine with going ahead and waiving it. But I recall June 26th, the date of the filing of that demand, was the first one. But I would note by the time that demand had been made, the court was in a difficult position because on June 6th and June 12th, both of those dates, defense counsel had made Frank's motions, and that had to be heard before they could get to a speedy trial. And I might note that even when the Franks hearing was held, and I believe that was late September, defense counsel asked for 2 weeks in order to brief the matter for the court, and the court got its order out fairly promptly in early November. But even before the court issued its order and before the state had a chance to file its brief, they made another speedy trial demand. So they're making requests and motions, but then before those motions are decided, they're making speedy trial demands, which really makes it impossible to comply with some of those things because those motions have to be heard.
But that's not, I mean, you agree that a defendant has dual rights, a right to have those legitimate issues presented and raised under the Fourth Amendment and also a Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. Those aren't
absolutely
exclusive.
I agree with that, Judge. But
so the defendant's put in the position, you make your motions, you want an omnibus hearing, and you are going to get more delay.
Essentially, that is it, Judge. And I would indicate, as I indicated in my brief, there is some case law that suggests that if the delay is due to defendant's motions, that is held against the defendant, not the state.
Although in this situation where the trial court concludes that the state had not given the confidential informant information promptly.
There is that finding. There is that finding.
Sort of like there's an old tune, the ear bone connected to the toe bone, hear the word of the Lord. I mean, something is, this one's connected to the other, and it just keeps going down the track in this case, it seems to me.
That's true. But in that same order, and I think even in the same paragraph, the judge also indicated, but then the Franks hearing was necessitated, and that was part of the delay as well. So I think that the trial court was basically coming close to balancing those. And I would submit that more responsibility ought to be against the appellant because of the Franks motion and the significant delay. I mean, that started on June 6th and wasn't decided until, I think, sometime in November, and that had to be done. And as I indicated, there is case law that suggests delay due to defense motions is held against the defense in evaluating the length of the delay. And I would submit here, particularly the Franks motion, was very significant. I would also like to just touch on the fact.
By the way, you're right, I misread my own note. It was June, not January. I had the wrong letter for the first request for a speedy trial.
Yes, I think it was June 6th and then June
26th.
Yes. I would like to touch on the issue of prejudice here. The trial judge made a determination that there was no prejudice. And the case law, as I indicated in my brief, indicates that there are basically three types of prejudice. And counsel mentioned those. Oppressive pretrial incarceration, concern and anxiety on the part of the defendant. But the most important one is the impairment of the defendant's right to a fair trial. And I believe it was the Windisch case that indicated that if, in fact, the defendant's being held on another separate charge or hold, those first two issues of prejudice don't exist. And then you simply focus on the impairment of the defendant's right to a fair trial. And I would submit here that there was no impairment of the defendant's right to a trial. He had his trial. He decided to waive a jury trial, had a court trial. There were no missing witnesses. There was no memory loss by any of the witnesses. And if I recall correctly, I don't believe the defense called any witnesses or presented affirmative evidence, and the defendant did not testify.
You agree that the case law is, we have case law indicating that the prejudice prong is not one that's necessary for the defendant to meet.
I'm sorry, I missed that, Judge.
Prejudice is not necessary. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well,
it's not necessary for a speedy trial violation for the defendant to show actual prejudice.
Well, that's what I'm referring to. There's presumptive prejudice, and the presumptive prejudice is pretrial incarceration and anxiety. But those presumptions go away, according to our case law, as I cited in my brief, if, in fact, the defendant is being held on a separate charge, because the defendant would not be released in any event. And so the focus, again, comes back to the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Are we sure about that? I'm just, as far as the facts of this case, I was a little bit lost as to, Mr. Spurbeck pointed it out, I was lost in the interplay between the federal incarceration and the federal hold and the state incarceration, whether the feds were waiting for the state prosecution because the result would have an impact on either his sentence or conviction, I'm not sure.
It would have changed what he would have received in the federal system if, in fact, the conviction had been entered in this case. And the prosecutor wanted to wait until the state's case was completed before he was released to the federal hold. He, on the other hand, adamantly wanted to go to the federal hold, hoping that somehow he could get that released and then later come back to the state and post bail. But I would submit that there has to be a showing of actual prejudice, and I would rely on this court's recent decision from late 2018 that I cited, State versus Strobel, Strobel, to suggest that prejudice and actual prejudice is necessary. There, the first three factors weighed in favor of the defense, but there was no showing of prejudice, therefore the case was not dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hersey. Mr. Spurbeck, any rebuttal?
Just briefly, Judge Klopacki, there is a August 13th, 2017 order at page 5 that I think answers your question about Judge Walker's concerns that his discovery orders weren't being complied with. That is where I think when Judge Anderson then does his order, my guess is he's looking at back at Judge Walker's order to say, you, state, were ordered to do some stuff, and by the time we get to August 13th, Judge Walker is saying that stuff wasn't being done. I told you to disclose things. You didn't read my order right. You didn't do this stuff. That's what I looked at. So if you had a question about where you saw that, that might be it. One of the things that the state's brief really seems to want to, on appeal, relitigate some issues. When Judge Anderson filed that December 1st order laying out his findings and his order to release, I do not believe the state filed a motion to reconsider to contest what he had done. If the state was contesting the judge's findings, that was the time to do it, not on appeal. Because really what the state is asking you to do is to go back through those transcripts and say, oh, maybe Judge Anderson, maybe this was wrong, maybe. That's not how we do it. We have a judge who had an order. And the state's saying, well, he didn't have the transcripts. We don't know he didn't have the transcripts. And even if he didn't have the transcripts, we don't know that Judge Anderson didn't have access to the court reporter records. And this 60-day finding that the state says is clearly erroneous, I agree that, and I don't have the, I apologize, I don't have the date of the hearing. I agree that Judge Walker said, I'm going to find a 60-day good cause here. That's fine. It does not matter to me. What we have for Judge Anderson is a 120-day violation. So he may be wrong about, well, no one's ever found a 60-day good cause on the record. It certainly wasn't in writing, but it was, you know, Judge Walker says it. I don't think that matters. And the fact that that one may be wrong doesn't mean anything else he said is clearly erroneous or wrong. The global question, and I think we agree on this, is de novo review. It's a constitutional issue. Within that constitutional issue, we're going to have historical facts. We might have some mixed that get a more deferential standard. At the end of the day, it's a constitutional question. But Judge Anderson has done, in that December 1st order, has done a lot of the work on the speedy trial part of this. I don't think I've ever worked on a case where the judge actually wrote a speedy trial order. Sometimes they just say deny. But this one, the judge is going to look at it. And I think the reason that Judge Anderson is looking at it is because he has been assigned to this case, and he is staring back at 11 months that this man has been in jail, and he can see very clearly that there are requests to move the case along. So this idea that the Franks hearing consumes a whole bunch of the time and has to be weighed against the defendant, what Judge Anderson is saying is that that Franks hearing should have happened much faster and much sooner. And he is attributing the delay on the Franks issue to the state because of the discovery issues, and that's where I'm going to go back to that August 13th order. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your briefing and for your oral argument today. Well done. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within our statutory period. Thank you.